My name's Rusty Lavely. I'm an alcoholic. I have to put my old man glasses on now. I didn't used to have to wear those. I had LASIK surgery several years ago, and it worked for a while. And now I can't see y'all, but I can see my paper. So I'm from here in Atlanta. Welcome to the city. We're glad you're here. Let me take these off so I can see you while I talk to you before I start having to look at stuff. We've been working for months to get you guys here, and we're so happy that you came. It's been an adventure for us, for sure. I will warn you, I heard a report this morning that there's going to be about 250,000 others of Atlantans here tonight for the fireworks and all that. So we're a majority until this evening, and then we become a minority again in the bigger population for fireworks and all that in downtown. So get ready. You thought last night was bad. Just get ready for tonight. just giving you a fair warning. So plan to hang around for a while and enjoy after the meetings. So my sobriety date is the 17th of March, 1999. I have a sponsor who's sitting right here on the front row, and I am a sponsor. My home group is Rule 62. We meet at the 8111 Clubhouse on Roswell Road in Sandy Springs, Georgia, which is the first suburb north of Atlanta in Fulton County. We meet on Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays at 8 p.m. I'm the alternate GSR for the group. I'm humbled to have been asked to participate in this. It's a wonderful feeling to know that you might have something that you can share with someone that might help somebody out sometime down the road. And everything I'm going to tell you is not original, except the one story about my grandmother. And I'm sure many of you have stories like it. As I was listening to the gentleman from Australia speak last night, and he was talking about his mom, I thought, oh boy, that's exactly the same story I'm going to tell in a slightly different details, but it's going to be very similar. As I was writing this, I cried like a baby. And then when I read it again, I cried like a baby. And then when my wife read it to review it, she bawled like a baby. And then when I sent it to my sponsor to review it, he said he got teary-eyed too. So all these people knew my grandmother, so they know how important she was to me and to them as well. So hopefully I'll make it through that part of it without too much goofing on the stage, just breaking down and babbling. So step 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. You know, it's steps 4 through 9 are what we do to clean up our past. Before we can do step 9, obviously we have to figure out who we are and what we did. I was one of those alcoholics who believed that I wasn't hurting anybody. I didn't even think I was hurting myself. I was just doing what I wanted to do, and I really, up until the day I entered a treatment center, I thought I was going to quit on my own. I really believed that, and then I thought the next day life was going to be normal again. Of course, during all this time, I had lost family, jobs, friends, money, you name it, it was all gone. I was 2 or 3 months late on rent, utilities. I was about to be kicked out of my apartment. I was about to be what I thought an alcoholic was, the guy that lived under the bridge and raincoat and pushed the shopping cart around. But I really still thought I was in control. So I destroyed that. I destroyed everything. I destroyed my career. I destroyed all the relationships that I had with my family, my friends. I lost all my stuff. And to me, stuff's kind of important sometimes. It's less important today, but I still like it. And it wasn't until I was about 8 months sober and I was completing my fourth step that I realized that I really was a selfish, self-centered, arrogant ass. I treated people horribly. I used them up. I just abused people. Not physically, but I did everything I could to get everything I could out of other people and life and use it to my own ends, my own gain. And as my alcoholism and the other things that I did progressed, it became worse and worse and worse until, like I said, they just said, no, we can't do it anymore. And the last link in that chain was my grandmother telling me that she didn't want to see me anymore. I lived in Savannah at the time. That's where she lived. And it was, I didn't even realize how important that was at that point. But I did know that it was big. Because she, as you'll find out, she was very important to me. As I went through my fourth step and did my fifth step, And then I turned those things about myself over to God as I'd come to understand God. I knew I had developed this list. I'm an intellectual. I spend a lot of time in education. I've got a lot of degrees, a lot of letters after my name. And so I know how to do homework. I'm pretty good at homework. I can write. I can read. I read ahead in the book, and I knew that I was going to have this list that I needed to prepare for my eighth step. You know, I had to prepare ahead and get things done. My wife will tell you I prepare too far ahead. She has to put the brakes on all the time. I have to be very clear about what my instructions are. Otherwise, I'll get too far ahead in the process. That hasn't changed. It's the same. So I knew I was preparing this list in my fourth step for my eighth step. And when I got to my eighth step and looked back at my fourth step, I realized that I had harmed a lot of people. I had abused people. I had just used people up. And it was obvious to me that I had a lot of amends to make. So I took my eighth step list, I really broke mine down into three categories. The financial amends, which are kind of impersonal but obviously important, and those are obviously very direct amends. You pay them. And that's a pretty direct thing. But what I did with my direct amends was I was in a treatment center at the time, and one of the counselors was working with me. And what I did was I wrote up a short letter. This is who I am. This is where I am. This is what I'm doing. I didn't have a job at the time. You know, with the education that I have, I couldn't get a job at McDonald's, Walmart, wherever. Fortunately, a friend in the program's family owned a printing company, and they hired me to work for $8 an hour, which was a pretty significant drop in income for me, but I was grateful to have it at that point because I didn't have anything else. And I call that my treatment job. And so I worked there for a while. And what Dave did for me at treatment center was we crafted a short letter and put that information in there, and I sent him a check for $5. Every one of my creditors, I listed them all, how much I owed them, and I paid each of them $5 a month for several months. Then after 6 months or so, I got a raise. So I increased it a little bit to $10 a month, something like that. And I'll never forget when I paid the first one off. You know, the debts range, not counting my student loans, the debts range from $500 to $25,000. It was a significant amount of money. And the student loans, fortunately, were in deferral since I was in a treatment center. They gave me a little bit of grace. And so I started paying them. Slowly but surely, I paid them. I made my best deal with them. I kept to that. And after several years, it took a while of leaving treatment, leaving the treatment job, moving on back into my career, you know, substantial increase in salary at that point. But I was able to pay all of those debts off. It took 4 or 5 years for that to happen. Not the student loans just yet. I'm not going to really address that, but those did get paid off. They're gone. It took a little longer. It was a little bit bigger sum. So I had the list and I made those amends. And for me, direct amends was writing the letter, acknowledging my wrong and doing my best to make the payments to make those, amends to those institutions. However, institutions are pretty, you know, they're pretty impersonal. To me, those were the easiest ones to make, even though the money wasn't necessarily there all the time. They were the easiest ones to make because I didn't have to face anybody. It was simply something that I did. So the other two lists on my eighth step were what I've come to call the few-timers and the long-timers. The few-timers are the people that I just saw once or at most a couple times, few times, but I managed to abuse or hurt them in some way. And the long-timers are the people like family and friends and coworkers, people that I'm in constant contact with. And over the years of being in contact with those folks, my selfishness, self-centeredness, and arrogance just rode over them and abused them to no end until finally they said no more. The few-timers were relatively easy and straightforward for me. I had them on a list, and for the most part, I knew how to get in touch with them. I'd grown up in Tennessee, and I was in Atlanta at the time. But I was able to get in touch with those folks, sometimes face-to-face, sometimes by phone. And my sponsor and I decided, you know, what was the best way to approach these folks, what was the best way to interact with them, and what amends did I need to offer to them to make up for my past. You know, it was funny because oftentimes the few-timers don't even remember who I am. They have no idea what I did to them. But it was something that was important enough to me that I remembered it. And if I remembered it, then I needed to do something about it. And so for the few-timers, it was often a, this is what I did. You know, I'm trying to get sober. This is part of the process for me, and this is what I need to do. And most of the time, if they remembered it all, it was, okay, that's fine. I appreciate it. I don't remember, or it wasn't that big a deal to me at the time, and I've gotten over it. And so they were fine. When that happens, it creates an immense sense of spiritual growth for me, because I realize that I'm able to apologize and make amends for the things that I've done, the people that I've hurt. And that's translated itself into who I am today and how I follow the 10th step. I almost always know very, very quickly if I've harmed somebody. It doesn't take long anymore. Sometimes I know it as I'm doing it, because the selfish, self-centered, arrogant ass isn't completely gone yet. Ask my wife. She'll tell you. I'm still that person. I hope and I believe that I'm a lot better than I was. But invariably, I still harm people. I still hurt people. I don't want to. I don't necessarily set out to. But it happens. And that's not an excuse that I'm a human being, or it's not an excuse that I'm an alcoholic. It just happens. Progress, not perfection, we like to say, right? Well, I think I'm making progress, and so I hope that I stick to that. So when I do a 10th step, I make amends almost invariably very quickly now, or at least I try to. And if I don't, I end up talking about it with my sponsor, and we figure out the plan that needs to happen. The lifelongers can be a little more of a challenge. Lifelongers are our family, our close friends, our coworkers, people that were around a long time. They maybe know who we used to be, and they certainly know who we became. It's oftentimes a close-knit group of people. There were probably only 10 to 15 of those that I could count on that list, but I had interacted so significantly with them and abused and hurt them so badly for years and years and years that while they love me and care about me, they can't take it anymore. And so it's often a dichotomy, at least, that I've seen. They love it that you're coming to them. They love it that you're acknowledging that I'm acknowledging what I'm doing, but they're wary and they're weary. They want to see what happens. They can't open themselves up to the potential for pain and suffering anymore. They've dealt with it for too long. And so that's what happened in my case. You know, my family was more than willing to hug me, tell me they love me, but they needed to see progress. So really, oftentimes for this lifelonger group, there's kind of this dual thing. There's this direct amends, which we have to make. I had to sit down with each one of these people and admit my faults. And I tried to come armed with a plan, or I tried to talk with them about what I could do to make things better. Well, with a few timers, sometimes it's pretty easy. It's an apology. It's an I'm not going to do that anymore. And often you're not ever going to see those people again. And so if they accept the apology, which the vast majority of them did in my case, in fact, all of them did in my case that I can think of, that's kind of it. I just grow from that, and hopefully they've taken something out of it if they remembered what the issue was, and then they move on, because we probably won't interact again. But the lifelongers will see me on a constant basis, and so I'll need to make something that we call living amends. And so I want to just touch on that a minute. I know this is direct amends, but living amends, I think, are important, because for the lifelongers, for the people that we know for a long time and will continue to know for a long time, making a single direct amends is not sufficient. It's important. It has to happen. I can't just say to myself, I'm just going to be a better person around these folks. That doesn't work because we haven't really faced with that person what we did to them, and what we're going to do about it. And hopefully they'll accept our amends. If not, they will certainly offer opinions as to what we can do to make amends to them. So living amends are a vital part of the lifelonger group, in my opinion. The direct amend is just the starting point of living a different life, of becoming a different person. Because, you know, by the time I got to the ninth step, I was changing. I mean, people around me saw it before I did, but I was changing. I was becoming different. I was treating people differently. I was acting differently. I was thinking differently. You know, I had developed this relationship with God as I understand God, or as I understood Him at the time. Obviously, that changes over time, too. It grows and changes. I was getting more involved in Alcoholics Anonymous at the time, or still am, obviously. I'd gotten to the ninth step, and I was moving on, and I was beginning to sponsor people at that point as well. The best personal example that I can come up with for amends is with my grandmother, as I said earlier. We called her Meemaw. My mother was an only child, and my parents had two. I was the oldest, and my sister was a couple years younger than me. My grandmother thought I hung the moon, and she put me up on this amazing pedestal. And in return, I did the same thing. She was everything to me. I loved Meemaw. So we called her was Meemaw. She was just everything. She did everything for us. She took us everywhere. She taught us things. She was our biggest supporter. You know, she financially helped us on occasions. And in a lot of ways, and this isn't to blame her, a lot of that taking helped me develop, you know, the kind of taker that I became, because I expected everyone to be just like that. I didn't realize that grandparents just do that. I thought everybody should do that. especially when it came to me. and I didn't get the giving side of it very well. I didn't understand that she was giving because she loved us and she wanted what was best for us. My grandmother was a very educated woman. She taught in the Savannah Public High Schools for 33 years. She was a very spiritual woman. She was a member of church and Baptist Church in Savannah for her entire life. Same church. She taught the pastors how to preach on given Sundays. She knew the Bible backwards and forwards. And I thought she was a very religious woman, and I think she probably was. It took a long time before I realized she was a very spiritual woman as well. And I disagreed with her brand of religion. As I got sober, I didn't buy into what I thought the policeman Santa Claus concept of God was, because that's what I thought. I thought God was out there, and when I was bad, I got punished, and when I was good, I got presents. When I got sober, Meemaw was my biggest supporter again, but obviously she was cautious. After 6 or 7 years, I'd finished my training. I moved back to Savannah, and I met my wife, and we got married a year later. Now, my family loves my wife. I think they love my wife more than they love me, but that's okay. Patty and I did a lot of things with my grandmother for several years while she was still alive. She got to where she couldn't take care of her home and had to move into a living assisted living facility. And so we would go see her and spend time with her. And it was becoming obvious to the family that she was changing, that she was beginning to repeat herself multiple times, ask the same question over and over, that she was beginning to develop dementia. And I'm a physician, and so I could understand what was going on. And I'll never forget. So I had made direct amends to my grandmother, and I was making living amends that I would make until the day she died, because I felt I owed her that. And I felt that it was good for me because I was becoming a better person. But I was sitting on the sofa in her... I was sitting on the sofa in her living room. She was sitting in her chair next to me. She knew what was going on. She'd figured it out by this time. She reached over and patted me on the cheek. She said, "It's your turn now." And I knew exactly what she meant. It was my turn to take care of her. You know, if I hadn't been sober, I couldn't have done it. There was no way I could have been there for her or anybody else. She had emergency surgery a few months later. And she never recovered from a coma she was in. It's funny because I'm sitting in the room. I'm the alcoholic, right? And everyone's looking at me to figure out what to do. I don't want to let her go. But I know it's the right thing to do. I know it's what she would want. And so I had to decide when to turn the machines off. I've been through this a bunch of times. I wasn't supposed to cry. And so even my mother, her daughter, looked to me to decide when was the time. No one was going to do it until I said it was okay. That's how important Mima was to me. I prayed about that a lot for a few days. And once everyone had been able to come and see her and say goodbye, we turned everything off. And I remember wailing, like crying like a baby in the ICU at Memorial. It hurt so bad, but I knew it was the right thing to do. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me my life back. I never could have done any of that as an active alcoholic. And it was hard. It's the hardest thing I've ever done outside of getting sober. I miss her. I miss her a lot. I think about her a lot. We're in Savannah. We go by the graveside, say hello, see how she's doing. Excuse me. They didn't have Kleenex. I had to use toilet paper. I might need a whole roll. I think she's up in heaven. She's got God organized. She's told him what he needs to know about spirituality and all. You know, I came to realize that my grandmother was a very spiritual lady. I just didn't understand her brand of religion, but that was okay. I now understand her brand of God. And there's a big difference. And you all taught me that. And one part of that process was making amends, making direct amends. You know, the Ninth Step Promises starts, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. I'm amazed every day at what this program has given me. And I thank every one of you for it. Thank you.
I'd like to thank you so much, Rusty, for sharing your experience with your grandmother. Grandmothers are special, very special. Our next speaker is Carol, and Carol is from Wichita, Kansas, where Dorothy is from. So I give you Carol.
Good morning. Happy birthday, America. My name's Carol Roloff, and I'm alcoholic. My home group is the newcomers group, Wichita, Kansas, and I have to give a big shout out to all my Kansas contingency out there. Thank you for all your love and support. I certainly do appreciate that. And my Canadian friends who are almost Kansans. I thank you for your love and support also. What an honor to be able to stand up here before you and speak. I'm fairly nervous. It's not that I haven't done this before. It's just that I always get nervous, and I may run out of words, and if I do, I'll try and sit down. We're here to talk about making direct amends, and I have been fortunate enough to be in the program for a while. My sobriety date is November the 20th, 1982, and I'm extremely grateful for that. You know, if it wasn't for the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not sure that I would be around. So I'm grateful for that, and I don't think I would want to be around unless I had the life that you guys have given me, and I certainly appreciate that too. So I could go on for more than 20 minutes on just talking about gratitude, but that wasn't my assignment, so I'm going to try to talk about making direct amends. And, you know, when I first sobered up, I was not going to make any amends, direct or otherwise. I just came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to be fixed. You know, I wanted you all to fix me, and boy, did you ever. But I had a sponsor that assigned herself to me, and she was an old maid school teacher, and so we did a lot of writing, and, you know, she saved my life, and I miss her dearly. But when it came down to doing the amends, first of all, you know, like Rusty said, the steps are in order, and I believe they're in order for a reason. You know, in steps one, two, and three, we develop a relationship with a higher power. We make a commitment to a higher power that if we get busy and do the steps and do the work, then we'll leave the outcome to him, and he'll take care of us. And that certainly has worked for me. And then when we come to four and five, you know, that's where we realize who we are and what we did, and that's where we get our list to make amends. And my list from my first step, well, the first step I gave in treatment, and after I was about a quarter of the way through these millions of pages of notebook or yellow paper, the little nun patted me on the head and told me I'd do better the next time, and dismissed me. And I then got a sponsor and was more directed in my fourth and fifth step. But anyway, that's where my list came from. And to this day, some of the same people are on that. Not always, but some of them are. And then when we do 6, 7, and 8, we learn about our character defects. And we also learn about willingness, and we learn about humility. And if we can put all of that together, then we're ready to make direct amends. And that took me a while, and it took me, I needed the help of a sponsor, and I needed the help of the fellowship, and, you know, it took a while. And, you know, but the big book tells us that this is a step where we, you know, where we clean up this, our side of the street, and then we can walk in the sunlight of the Spirit. And I always have loved those words. There's just something very compelling about working or walking in the sunlight of the Spirit. And I know that was one of the things that kept me writing down the things that I needed to write down, and continuing to just one at a time do the amends. And like Rusty, I too was told to write a letter. And first of all, I was told to reflect on my list, and to you know, put people in columns also. And my columns were like amends now, amends later, amends maybe, and amends never. And there were names on all those lists, and you know, so I was also told that I was supposed to, if I didn't have the willingness to do it, then I was supposed to pray for that willingness, and I pray for willingness still today. That's part of my daily ritual. I am not naturally willing, and so I pray for willingness on a daily basis, and through the grace of God, I'm still sober. The book also tells us that, there are lists that we need to do now, and then there are partial restitutions that we can't completely disclose because we might hurt someone or others if we do that. And there are also some that we need to maybe defer the action because we just aren't ready to do it yet. And then there are others where they are gone, we don't know where they are, and we might never be able to make amends to them. But it doesn't matter. It didn't matter to my sponsor where any of these people were on those lists. I was still to write the letter. And because of the character that my sponsor had, she reviewed all my letters before I was even allowed to make these amends. And she taught me a really good method to do this, and I'm grateful for it because it talks about this in the book, but I don't think I would have ever recognized it the way she put it. And she said that we must be ready to take the full consequences, to take the responsibility of the well-being of others at the same time. So I had to be ready to take the consequences of what I was going to tell these people, but I was also supposed to be ready to take their well-being in mind too. And that is kind of contradictory to me. I didn't understand that at first, and so she gave me good guidelines. And as I went back and read that, it was. The direct directions that were there, and so when I started my letters, I told whoever I was making amends to what I was doing, that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and for me to stay sober, I had to make these amends, and then I was also to list some of my character defects, some of the reasons why I had to make the amends. Not the exact episodes or those kind of things, but my selfishness, my self-centeredness, my procrastination, my laziness, my I don't give a you-know-what attitude. And so I had to talk about my character defects. I was not allowed to talk about the character defects of anyone else, that I was going to talk to, and I was not allowed to make excuses. That's just who I was when this happened, and that was an eye opener for me. Although I thought I had learned all that in my fourth and fifth step, it was the sixth, seventh, and eighth step where I learned the willingness and the humility, so that I could really look at those character defects and see how important they were for me to know about me. For me to be able to understand some of the things that I did. And, when I was drinking, I certainly had no humility, and I didn't particularly even, I'm selfish and self-centered. I'm still that way today, even after all these years. And I'm not sure when that's going to go away, but I still continue to work on it. And, I never thought about your well-being. I was busy thinking about my well-being, and my mind was all full of me, and I couldn't see anything else. And so I talked about my character defects, and I made sure that she went through and crossed out all my excuses, and then we went on. Then the next thing that I did She talked to me about talking about the person's well-being, not so much the harm that I had done to them, but the gratitude that I had for the lessons that I learned from them. The lessons that I learned, you know, most of these people were not evil people. And although they may have had some part in, you know, the harm that was done to them, that probably was because of my attitude and my, you know, my selfishness and my total irrespect of those people. And so I had to take a look at that and see that, yes, these people, I just manipulated them and took advantage of them. And why wouldn't you fight back if someone was doing that to you? It had never entered my mind that that's what I was doing. I knew nothing about myself when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I lived in some kind of a fantasy land, or probably two or three different fantasy lands, and picking and choosing whichever one was the best for that day. And sometimes I got several during one day. And, you know, so I, by the time I got here, I was really a mess. And, you know, denial was my best friend. I didn't drink that much, and I wasn't like you. And, you know, I could stand there with one of those 52-ounce cups full of rum and Diet Dr. Pepper because I didn't want to get fat. Or when I first started, it was Tab, I think. Oh, God, that tasted awful. But anyway, you know, and tell you that I wasn't drinking. And believe it myself, you know, I was pretty sick. And so to overcome those kind of things and to make it to step 9 was actually a miracle, you know, a miracle for me. And so anyway, I did talk about their gratitude and how much I appreciated certain things that they had done and you know, they're being there for me and they're being in my life and, you know, anything that I could think to change from how I felt into gratitude. And, you know, that was hard enough. And then at the end of my letter, after I'd already talked about my character defects and how grateful I was to have them in my life, and, you know, some of that was really bittersweet. It was hard. Some of these letters went back and forth many times before they were, had a red check mark on them that they were ready to use. And, then the last thing, I did was, I had to ask them questions. Questions like, were there any other harms I failed to address and what can I do to make it right between us? And those were the things that I didn't want answers for. You know, because by the time I had gotten to that place, I didn't think that there was any way to make things right. And then depending on the type of amends I was making, I had to talk about, are there any other wrongs that I might be able to make right? And, you know, a lot of times these people did have other things that they had resentments about. And, you know, I was a little frustrated part of the time because I wasn't really allowed to vent my resentments, except to my sponsor. And, you know, she had plenty of words for that. My dear Canadian friend remembers how many times I said to her, how important is that? And, you know, those were the things she said to me. And, so, you know, but all in all, it ended up being a very, very spiritual process. And I think the reason that it's a spiritual process, even though it's difficult And even though it sounds like it's just, you know, we're doing it for ourselves, we're cleaning our side of the street, that's not really, really what I was doing. What I was doing was, that was the beginning of me learning how to forgive myself and to forgive other people. That part about talking about my character defects and that part about talking about the gratitude I had for them and to be in my life and the things that they had done, you know, that changed my whole way of thinking. It allowed me to see good in something that I thought was bad. And, you know, when I first got to this program, I was told that I all I needed to do was to forget anything and everything I ever thought was right. And sometimes that was pretty difficult to do because for a long time I think I would rather be right than happy. It's not that way today, but it, when I first came in, it probably was. And, you know, so being able to see the good part in these people was the first step towards learning how to forgive. And I know today that if we don't learn how to forgive and we keep these resentments, that it will lead us back to drinking. Or if it doesn't lead us back to drinking, it will certainly lead us back to a life of misery. And that's not what I want. I mean, the theme here is happy, joyous, and free. And I felt that way for a long time. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the fellowship, and I love getting to come and see, you know, all the people from all the different places. And you know, I never feel alone, and when I'm in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I always feel like I'm at home. That's who I am, and you understand that. And I understand you, and we may never know each other's names, but we may be the most intimate friends in the world and, you know, share things that we would never share with anyone else. And I always thought that that was such a contradiction and such an amazement. But it's part of what makes the program work. It's our common bond, and it's alcoholism. And, you know, who would have ever thought that when I was drunk and out of my mind and that there would be this many other people that had been drunk and been out of their mind, too. Thank God we weren't all in the same room at the same time. You know, the reason why that, you know, forgiveness is so very, very important to me is the fact that, you know, there's one statement in chapter 9 that says that our purpose is to make ourselves, and I can't do the quote because I know it. I say it all the time and then I get up here and I can't remember. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people around us. And I think that's what I've truly found as I go through the amends process. And, you know, I've been sober for a while, but not sober long enough that I don't have to continue to do fourth and fifth steps. I know that, you know, some alcoholics believe that after you've done so many fourth and fifth steps, or maybe even the first one or something, then you can go on to step 10 and continue to take amends on a daily basis. And I do that. And like Rusty said, it's not hard to make amends now when you recognize it right away. I have no problems in saying that I was wrong. I have that little bit of open-mindedness to be able to see that. I still have to do a fourth and fifth step on a periodic basis. And I know that every time that I go through those 12 steps, I have some kind of a spiritual awakening. And, you know, that's what step 12 tells us. And it's true. It's been true for me. And it's no, you know, I didn't ever have a huge, big burning bush and, You know, my husband had a transformer that blew up outside his window when he did his, but that wasn't what happened to me. I've just had small awakenings, and most of the time it's just me learning more about me, because I knew nothing about me. And it's remembering the little things that my sponsor has told me. You know, smile at everyone. When you're walking down the street, just smile at everyone. You know how hard that was for me to do at first? And now it's just kind of a natural thing. And Rusty talked about progress and not perfection. And I'm still working on that. And I don't know how sober you have to be to have completed that, but I'm not there yet. And so I think I got a few more years in me to keep working on it. And one of the things that he alluded to too is that at the end of the ninth step, it's where the promises are. And before that, it says, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we ought not to urge them to do that. But we have to live a spiritual life. And I don't think I have time to go through and read all the promises, but I'm not a big book thumper, so I can't tell you what pages everything, you know, all the important things are on, but I know page 449 isn't 449 anymore, but I know what it says when it used to be page 449. And that's what's important to me, is that I know where to find my solutions today. I know where the directions are. I know where the directions are for the 10th step. I know where the directions are for the 11th step. I know where the directions are for the 9th step, and they're in my big book. And I have one at home that is so underlined, and the pages are all falling out because the underlining has kind of rotted them out, I think. But, you know, I still know where everything is in that book. And that's for me, the guide to stay sober. And one of the biggest parts was the making amends, being able to clean up my side of the street, being able to try to be of maximum service. And I'm never quite sure what God's will is. I have an intuitive idea, which I think comes from the promises. But I do know that I just need to do the next right thing. And I try to be of maximum service to the fellowship. I've done tons and tons of service. I was very, very fortunate and honored to be able to serve as delegate from Area 25, which is Kansas. And that was such a humbling experience. And I'm part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to me, if I hadn't done the amends, I never could have been part of. And I'm not on the outside looking in anymore. I can walk down the street and I can smile at everyone that I see. I won't tell you that there aren't people out there that I still need to make amends to. Every time I go through and do a four step, or every time I go through the book, I know that every time I go through the book, that I do have the spiritual experience, and I do learn something about me. And there are always people that pop up that I hadn't thought about that are on my fourth step. And I think I've probably talked too long. I just appreciate you telling me asking me to be here. And I do want to give a big shout out to the alcoholics in Atlanta, because you guys have just done an excellent job and we're just having a great time. So thank you.
I'd like to thank Carol for her time and sharing with us. And there's a little deviation on the program. We were scheduled with another speaker, but they didn't arrive for whatever reason, and we will pray for them. But we've asked Bob, who is from New Market, Maryland, a past delegate, as well as Carol was, to come up and share with us on his experience on the Ninth Step. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Bob C., and I'm a deviation. I like that. I like that. Hit the nail on the head there, Donna. And I'm an alcoholic. And as my first service sponsor always reminded me, I'm always a substitute in Alcoholics Anonymous because anybody can step up to fill something that I would have been doing. I'm clearly a substitute this morning. As I left the room this morning, my wife said, "Do you have anything to do today?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm going to have fun." She said, "No, on the program." And I was like, "No, when we send in the registration, there's a box that says, are you a giver or a taker?" I checked taker. And God and Carmela had other plans. I thank you, Carmela, for that. We will keep Wayne in mind. I actually came here to hear Wayne's experience on the Ninth Step, and instead, I get to hear my own, and you get to hear them too. That's what the topic is this morning: direct amends. As I said, my name is Bob C. I'm an alcoholic. I got sober April 17th, 1987. I didn't really get sober that day. It began to happen about a year later. But the dryness started then. And my home group is the Antiques Group in New Market, Maryland. I want to thank Donna for chairing the meeting. And Rusty and Carol, thank you for your shares. And I don't know your name, but thank you very much for the fine job you're doing. ASL is... I wouldn't know, but ASL takes a long time to learn, and I'm also told that if you do it for more than 20 minutes in a row, you get really tired, and I think these people are doing a wonderful job going for an hour and a half at a time. It's amazing. I came into AA... Really, I was a sociopath. These people related it very well too. I had no idea of the effects of my actions on other people. I remember a number of times in my childhood and especially teenagerhood and beyond, my mother uttering the word son. Son, you have no idea how many people your actions have affected today. And that became really a litany. And I didn't. To me, y'all were like on a movie screen in front of me. It was two-dimensional. I really didn't, I think, fully appreciate until after I came into AA that you guys had feelings and thoughts and lives, universes inside your head, three-dimensional worlds just like I did. And it was that lack of insensitivity that led to a fairly long amends list, actually. My first year in AA, I pretty much winged it and went to a whole lot of meetings. It was meetings. To the point of making meetings compulsively and counting them and talking at meetings about, you know, the steps I'd done and the experience I had. And you know, you might have a meeting on the Ninth Step and you share on that. And then the fourth step the next week, you're talking about, well, I need to do a fourth step. And then after a while, you got to keep track, you know, of who was at what meeting and what you said in front of who. And everybody knows you're lying but you. And that you was me. And at about a year, my service sponsor, Fred T. from Greensboro, North Carolina, who's gone on to the big meeting now, but he was real slick. He got me into this GSR job, and I went to an area assembly, and I met people there who had actually come in after I had, who appeared on their outsides to be doing better than I felt on the inside. And I went home from that weekend, and I said, so what are they doing that I'm not doing? And the answer was they had moved on beyond step three. And I was really, I thought I was stuck on step four, but I was really stuck on step three because I hadn't picked up a pen and started step four. And so I said, you know, I'm going to do what they've done, and I'm going to work these steps. And there at about 13 months, I started through the process of working the steps, and things began to get better. When I reached step eight, that was easy because Fred was my service sponsor. Ed was my recovery sponsor, but Ed had never really worked the steps the way they're written in the book. He was much more of a fellowship sponsor. Ed died sober and happy at age 17 in AA, and he died of old age. He was 17 years sober. But you know, the way I worked the things was I would go to Fred and find out what the book said about how to do them, and I do that, and then I go to Ed and, you know, if it required interaction, give him the information or read him the fifth step list or talk to him about the sixth or whatever. And that's completely stupid and unorthodox. But, you know, it actually proves that it works and that what works about it is the steps and not the sponsor or sponsors or anything like that. That it's really the principles applying them to our own lives that actually does the trick. And when we got to step nine, I thought, okay, we've got this list. And at the top of the list were my parents. I had harmed them seriously. I mean, for several years, most of the time, they didn't know where I was in my 20s. They went through a really rough time wondering if I was alive and dead for months at a time. And there were some financial amends there. So I went over to the house where they lived, about 60 miles away, and sat down with them and said, you know, I'm in AA. I've done these things. Mom's first thing was, thank you, Jesus. And I was like, you knew? And she's like, yeah, everybody knew but you, son. And made arrangements with them to pay off some debts, several thousand dollars. I think I got away with a whole lot there. But we agreed on a sum, and they said, just keep doing what you're doing. That's the only amends we want. And so I thought I was off the hook. Made the payments. Life went on. And fast forward about 15 years, and Dad was up in his 70s by that time. He's beginning to dotter a little bit. He was a bit infirm. They visited us in California. We were living out there for a few years, and I remember he said, we were walking to breakfast one day. We'd go down to the little place there on Pasadena Boulevard on Colorado Boulevard in Pasadena and have breakfast at a little diner. Guy time, you know. And he said, so how's things going there at work, son? I said, oh, they're going good. I mean, it's work, you know. Sometimes you have these little things with people, but you work them out. And Dad was a Baptist minister, and he loved to be naughty. You know, he said, well, you tell those people down there, they'd be good to my boy, or I'll come down there and whip their ass. And, I mean, he wasn't going to hurt anybody, and he knew it. And he was, you know, actually poking fun at himself, right? The fact of the matter was, I took it personal. Who is he to be saying he would stand up for me at this point in my life, you know, the big man? And a few other things like that. He made a remark or two about, you know, you better watch your weight, son. You don't want to let it get away from you. Well, again, who is he to talk to me about, you know, he's still treating me like a kid, or at least I thought these things, right? He was really just having fun. And treating me as a peer, you know, as a friend. If a friend sees his weight getting away from him, he might say a little something once, you know. And he said it once. So I mentioned it to my sponsor, and my sponsor said, well, you know, you're always yapping about these traditions here. Why don't you tell me what tradition that is. And I thank Carol for her copy. And so I said, well, I don't know. I guess, you know, part of it might be tradition four, autonomy, just personal autonomy. I'd need to grant him the autonomy to say what he wants to when he wants to, and really what he, you know, what he says is his right and not mine to say. He said, okay, what else? I was like, well, I don't know, maybe 10. Opinion on outside issues. Maybe I should have no opinion on what he thinks of me. That's an outside issue. And apply that tradition to my personal life here as well. And he said, okay, what else? And we went through and we found a few others that applied, not on a group level. You know, Bill said this in AA Comes of Age. I think it's around, I'm not a AA Comes of Age thumper, but I think it's around page 134, 135. He's wrapping up the traditions. And he says, I came to a place in my life where I wanted these traditions for myself as well as for AA as a whole. For myself. And then he goes into this thing of five or six sentences where he uses the word I instead of we as applied to the traditions. I wanted them because I needed them, because I had to have them, because I needed this peace of mind rather than we that we always say about the traditions. All the way home, right? That he says... He says, I needed these things for myself. And he uses the first person something like 15 times in the next few sentences. Really means this. And so James, my sponsor here, is saying, okay, you know, why don't you apply these things to yourself as a mantra? When if he says something like that, think of that. What he thinks of me is none of my business. That's really tradition 10. We hear it all the time, but it's tradition 10. Having no opinion on outside issues, because what you think of me is an outside issue for me. And so I did that. And I didn't realize it, but as time went on, the relationship changed. And I'm applying the traditions to the relationship. He doesn't even know the traditions are in the world. So they're being applied unilaterally, but the relationship changed. Was he changed? I don't think so. I don't think that because I was applying the traditions in my life to this relationship and this has something to do with direct amends, that I don't believe that a metaphysical screwdriver came down a moonbeam of light and twisted a screw in the back of my dad's neck and made him treat me as a peer instead of as a boy. What I believe is that the traditions applied to me changed me, and that changed my perception of the relationship, and probably nothing else changed. And so fast forward another 5 years or so. And at this point, Dad had really gone downhill a lot. He's sitting in bed. He's been to the hospital. He was, it was clear that he had a few weeks left to live. And I went down to, came down from Maryland where we live, went to Silva there in western North Carolina, just about 3 hours north of here, where I grew up. And they had moved back up there. And he was in a nursing home at the time and had spent the day together. I went out that afternoon and took care of some financial things with Mom. And she was worn out, so she went on home. And I went back over to the nursing home to just spend another hour or two with Dad before heading back north. And I was glad I did. We sat there and we talked a while. And after a while, our talk trailed off, and we're sitting there looking at the television. And I have no idea what was on or, you know, why it had preoccupied me for 2 or 5 or 10 minutes of silence or something. But I'd kind of forgotten he was there. And he's in bed, and I'm sitting in a chair beside his bed, and he's you know, about where Donna is there, sitting up in bed. And remember, Dad's a Baptist preacher. He was there at the end of his life. And out of the silence of sitting there for 2 or 3 minutes, he pipes up, and he says, I've always been obsessed with sex. Like, whoa. And he began to talk. And he gave me what was essentially a verbal fifth step. And so for that reason, all I will tell you about what he said is that basically none of it would have made most of us in this room blush. But a Baptist minister has a bit of a difficulty, seminary-trained minister, in that theology, that understanding of religion, as Rusty put it. He was saddled not only with everything he had said or done, but with everything he had thought. He felt that if you think it, you might as well have done it. You've got that kind of guilt. And so Dad was carrying a lot of guilt because he was a red-blooded American male and he had thought some thoughts. And he shared those with me, and a lot of his motivations for staying out of trouble and not acting on those thoughts had to do with the primary purpose, the hidden motives behind some of the moves that that we had made in our family life, geographical cures, if you will. And so he went on for about 2 years. No, 2 years. It seems like 2 years. It was two hours, and unloaded all that. For the first 10 minutes, I felt quite uncomfortable, and then I realized, you know what? This is just a fifth step. You got it. Just shut up, Bob. You're not supposed to be sitting here thinking this is not appropriate for him to be telling me this because I'm his son. He is treating you as a peer, which you always wanted. Now, AA has given you the tools to deal with that. Sit here and be his sponsor that he's asked you to be implicitly for the next however long it takes. Take a few notes, then give him the feedback and welcome him as a member to the human race, which then I got to do. Know what? Instead of being, you know, welcome to AA, or just like everybody else in AA, I said, welcome to the human race. You know, you're just like the rest of us. And topped his foibles with a few of my own. And we continued to talk for about 45 minutes. And he had concluded saying, so I guess you now know what a jerk your old man really was. And by the time we were done, he said, well, maybe I'm not such a bad egg after all. And Dad had about two more weeks. He had one more good day in there after that day, and then he kind of slipped away. And what you people gave me was really what every son wants. And it's not a rare story in AA. I tell this story, and there are a lot of people who come to me and say, you know what, my dad or my mom gave me that honor of a deathbed confession too. And a lot of times, for some weird reason, they pick the alcoholic in the family, the recovered alcoholic. This is the gift that that AA. I'm not checking text. I promise you, I'm checking the time. These are the gifts that AA has given us. This is about direct amends, right? To sum up about that story, I thought I was off the hook early on, right, with the money and the apology and just keep doing what you're doing. 20 years later, I got to finish the amends. That was not a living amends. These were all direct amends all the way through it, accepting him as he was. Having that experience with him at the end of his life, these were all direct amends. They were changed behaviors compared to the old Bob, and instead they were changed behaviors, which were the new Bob that you people made me into. When I came back, when Connie and I came back to After that week in North Carolina, he died. We went back down. We buried him. We took care of some things with Mom. We came back that weekend. We had a day. We had all been really well prepared. I did not expect to cry even and really to grieve Dad's loss. Of course, I grieved him. It was a missing hole in the world. And grief is nothing but love, as I learned. But we came back, and I hadn't had any real emotional display or anything like that. I went to work the first Monday back and sat down in a meeting, and people are talking about this lot of material has got to ship today, the whole, you know, henny penny, the sky is falling, the world is coming to an end, and business and money. And I just wanted to stand up and say, don't you people realize what has happened? This is all so insignificant. A great man has passed. And I got up and I walked out of the room, and I recognized what was going on, and I called employee assistance. I didn't even want to talk to my sponsor about it. My sponsor at the time was a psychology major in college, and he liked to play psychologist. And I wanted a real one, you know. And I sat down with this lady for a couple of times, and both times, this lady that I didn't even know, a counselor, I just came completely unglued in the first 2 minutes. And then the second time it happened, after I put myself back together, I said, Maya, why is it that I can cry in front of you over my dad's passing, and I can't cry in front of my wife? Now, this has to do with direct amends, too. And so we talked for a while about my relationship with my wife and what all we had been through. And fast backwards a few years, about 14 years, we had moved out to Oregon for me to go to graduate school. Connie was working. And for 5 years, I got busy in graduate school, and I don't recommend this, but between the ages of 7 and 12 in AA, I went to something like 4 meetings. It was mainly meetings when Connie would say something like, don't you think you need a meeting? And a couple of times I went to meetings in after a really close call. Connie thought I was going to drink. At 12 years of sobriety, I was doing better professionally than I'd ever dreamed I would get to do. Connie was living in Boston, Massachusetts, and I was living in Eugene, Oregon, but my marriage was absolutely fine, you see. On the inside, I would go home after a good day at school, very productive day, with a bright professional future in front of me. I would go home and smoke a cigar on the front porch and drink a glass of tea and do eeny, meeny, miny, moe between the 357 in the top drawer or the Hyundai into the bridge abutment at full speed. And I was not drinking at this point. I was 12 years dry, no meetings for 5 years, and I was more suicidal than I'd ever been before I came into the fellowship. My alcoholism had progressed even though I wasn't drinking. Untreated alcoholism is a wicked thing, let me tell you. During that time, later on I came back into AA, got busy, adopted a life of love and service, and I haven't felt that way since. Just want to be sure to get that out there. It does work if you keep working it. And during that time, Connie's dad died. This is what it has to do with direct amends. Back in North Carolina, she went home a few weeks before he passed. He had a long terminal illness. She called me up. She said, you know, he's going soon. You might want to get a plane ticket if you're coming. I got a plane ticket. I flew out there. I got there after he passed away. We went to the funeral. I think I may have stayed, 48 hours, maybe 72. Came back. She stayed for another few weeks and came on back. And I'd gone on back after 3 days. For the next year, I didn't know it, but Connie was fully involved in Al-Anon at the time and seeing a grief counselor to help her with issues following up her dad's death, and probably issues that had to do with the fact that her husband was not there emotionally during that whole time. I remember one time in particular, Connie's sitting in this room. This has to do with direct amends. I remember one time in particular that I walked in, and apparently she'd had a little rough day or something like that, or maybe I was just being, how did you put it? Some sort of 2 S words and an asshole. I walked in and, I need to write that down. Selfish, self-centered asshole. And that's good. Write that down. So, and I walked in and was making myself probably a glass of tea, and we didn't have an ice maker. We had the trays, and I pulled the trays out, and they were stuck together because the bottom one had been overfilled. And I proceeded to explain to her how you don't overfill the bottom one so that it sticks to the top one and causes, and she just started to cry. And I said, "Oh man, I've done it now. I'm so sorry, honey. Just don't worry about it. Just make your tea." And after I came back into AA, Connie explained that absence to me, and I did the best I could to make it right by being there. And as I talked to Maya, the counselor, after Dad had died, about the fact that I could cry in front of her, but I couldn't cry in front of my own wife, I began to realize I had not been there for Connie when her dad passed. So the deal in myself was, now I'm not going to allow her to be there for me. I'm not going to force her to be there for me. And I realized, I need to go home and talk to her about this that I just explained to you. And as I talked to her about that that night, I came completely unglued and cried in front of her the way I had cried with Maya. And Connie got up. Connie hates to be, does never try to pick up Connie. She would never sat in my lap before and has not since. She came over and she sat down in my lap in the big blue chair and held me for what seemed like 15 minutes. And she held me in a way that feels like she's still holding me physically right now. And I know she is from across the room. Allowing her to be there was my direct amends, paradoxically, for me not being there when she needed me. So that's the other part of direct amends for me. This has been kind of like a good murder mystery this morning. I think we've knocked off four family members between the three of us here in an hour and a half. I'd just like to leave you with a few words. Besides a reminder that the traditions are for us personally, like the steps are, I'd like to leave you with a few words that my dad gave me as a poem printed out. It was a poem from Rudyard Kipling, who himself was a dad, and it's a poem titled If, I-F, capital I, capital F. And it goes on for about a page, but I'm going to give you the first two lines and the last two lines of that poem, which were my dad's underscored lines when he gave it to me. It starts out, "If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you." Think of that. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, then you'll have the world and all that's in it. And what's more, you'll be a man, my son. Thank you for letting me share.